The question was asked, how are we to understand conflicting midrashim? Sometimes they seem contradictory. I think there are multiple answers to that question. One is in the Gemara in Tractate Megillah, describes that one of the Amoraim met Eliyahu Anavi. He asked them, what's their Bon Shalom doing now? He said, their Bon Shalom's learning the story of Pilegesh Begiva. He asked them, oh, great, we just had an argument in the academy about what got the husband so upset at his wife in the story of the concubine on the hilltop. And what did their Bon Shalom say if he was teaching this in the academy in heaven? So he said, oh, their Bon Shalom in heaven said, my son, quoted the name of one Amoraic opinion, says that he got upset because he found a hair. And my son, the other Amoraic opinion, says that he got upset because he found something in a soup. So so he says, wait a second. In Shemayim, they have questions. So what was he asking? In Shemayim, they have questions. Meaning, we know that the Ribbono Shel Olam leaves it to mankind to take control of their emotions. So on the one hand, in Shemayim, they don't get involved. Hakol bidei Shemayim chutz miyirat Shemayim. Hashem doesn't get involved about whether we'll get upset or not. That's our job, to take control of our emotions, right? But does that mean that in Shemayim they don't really have a record? What does that mean? It's one thing that Hashem doesn't get involved. Does that also mean that in Shemayim they don't know why the man got upset, which was the one that ticked him off? So Eliyahu says, no, they don't have a question in Shemayim. The question should teach you a lot. The fact that he asked such a question, that he worded it as a question, is really a class in and of itself. Me'ika sveika kamei shmaya. Is there a question in Shemayim? Maybe on another occasion we have to revisit that line in Talmud. But let's move forward. Let's assume it's as simple as we read it without going into depth. And then Eliyahu says, no, they don't have a question. But both happened. Both happened. And when one happened, he didn't blow up. And by the time the second one happened, then he did blow up. So both opinions have validity, have historical validity. They both happened. Now, there are other places where the Talmud discusses, the Talmud and then Tosfos discuss how you can rectify two conflicting opinions about creation, among other things. Number one, we see in Talmud that sometimes factually more than one thing happened. And the question is, which was the trigger? Sometimes it was cumulative. And the question is, which was the final catalyst? So that's one approach to arguments as to what happened historically. That's a simple approach. So that's number one. You see that in the Talmud. Sometimes there's a machlokas in Midrashim that would seem factual. And factually, they both happened. It's just a question of which was the catalyst. Okay? Number two. Sometimes they could have both happened. And there's another way to rectify the two, is the Talmud discusses with regards to creation. That sometimes a discussion of which happened first, the chicken or the egg, can really be that the chicken and the egg were formed, one with the right hand, one with the left hand, and there's more than one angle. But I don't want to go into that because that's not the prime answer that we can deal with. Our answer is either number one, or we'll move on to number two and number three. The one I just mentioned is when you reach that point in Talmud, when you study that, you'll see another answer, which we're not discussing here tonight. That discussion in Tosfos, that discussion of how we rectify two opinions of creation, how does that work? When was the world created? How was the world created? The machlokas in that, Tosfos discusses it also. How is that rectified? That's an answer we're not discussing here. And you'll see that the answers are not mutually exclusive. Answer number two is that sometimes when we learn a medrash, we're tempted to understand the medrash simplistically. We have to know that midrashim, by their very nature, are not to be taken literally. That doesn't mean that what they say literally is not true. What they say literally can be true, or it can be true on a beyond literal sense. We don't always know. Sometimes you need a tradition. People think Zohar. Well, you know what? Zohar is a medrash. People think Zohar is the secrets of Torah. So is Midrash Rabbah the secrets of Torah. So are the stories of the Talmud the secrets of Torah. Secrets of Torah, whenever the Talmud speaks about stories, so we read it and it's a nice story, but if we'd read a little bit beyond the surface, we'd understand that there's something much deeper going on here. Yeah? Last night, a kid was arguing with me about whether we have to be nice to everyone. And I said yes, and he said no. Wasn't a pleasant argument. He said to me, "You can be Hillel, but I want to be Shammai." And I said to him, Shammai says that you have to welcome everyone favorably. It's a Mishnah, Pirkei Avos. I said, according to Shammai, you also have to be nice to everyone. He says to me, Shammai was too tough with people. That was his point. I said, really? Shammai was too tough with people? Then how come Shammai was the chief rabbi of all of Israel? You know, if he had this fault in his traits, that he was so tough with people, like the stories we have in Tractate Shabbos, so then how'd they leave him in a position of leadership? Let him go fix his midot. So he said to me, doesn't the Talmud say that? So it reached a point where he was crossing the level where I felt there was already becoming too much chutzpah, that at some point I don't have to continue the conversation. So he's a kid. I said to him, look, we can always read a line in Talmud that says, "Lolam yehi adam," says, "Lolam al yehi adam kapdan kishamai." A person should always not be as accurate as Shammai. We can always read it like an Amharetz and just take it at face value, or we can have more depth and understand a little bit better what the Talmud was saying about the second greatest Jew of his time. Because Shammai was number two in his time. Hillel was number one, but Shammai was number two. So if we think we can just read that line in Talmud and walk on and say, yeah, just don't be like Shammai, that's it, right? Shammai was a toughie, that now I understand. I said, you know, you could read it like an Amharetz, you could read it like someone who doesn't understand what Talmud's all about, and leave it at that, or you could understand more depth. But as our conversation has to end now, so I guess we'll stay with the former. That was the end of our conversation last night. But we don't have to stay there. When we look at Talmud, and when we look at Midrash, and when we look at stories, so then we have to remember that there's multiple levels to every story. The stories were written with the following formula, as it says in the beginning of the book of Mishlei. The beginning of the book of Mishlei tells us the formula. When you want to tell a story, remember this when you guys are speakers. I try to adhere to this, and I find it to be very difficult. The formula, the Talmud says, is that your story has to have a positive message, even if people don't remember the point. The Pasuk says in Mishlei, "Lavin mashal umlitza." There has to be a good message to the simple interpretation of every story. A wise man formulates his stories so that you have the point you're trying to make, but even if you don't get the point, you walk away with a good message. The simple reading, okay? That's the formula. So then our sages, when they compile Midrash or the stories of Talmud, are working with that formula that we can walk away and say, I understood. And we'll walk away with a good message. But we might have missed the point. Right? So just like the Torah has Pshat, Remez, Drush, Sod, four levels of interpretation. Simple reading. What the Torah is alluding to. What you have to derive from the Torah and the secret the Torah is teaching you. By the same token, the Midrashim may have multiple levels of interpretation. And sometimes, when the Midrash says something, the Midrash is coming to point out a concept on the level of Remez, or Drush, or Sod. The Midrash is not necessarily coming to tell you, in Pshat, this is what happened. We learned an expansion of this in the Me'iri. The Me'iri in his introduction to Pirkei Avot, the Me'iri took a few samplings of Medrash and showed us how Chazal gave us a story, and then he said, okay, what do you think Chazal were telling you in that story? And the Me'iri went on to show, Zacharya, don't get me a cup of water. I'll get a cup of water in a minute. Thank you. That's why I'm sucking on a candy. But thank you. The Me'iri went on to show how sometimes the Medrash is giving us a message, but not to be taken literally. And the Medrash says now, and the Me'iri says now, extrapolate from here. So even though this is a very dangerous tool, people apply it liberally, and I'm not sure people should apply it at all. People should question and say, I don't know if this Medrash is to be taken literally. But we definitely know that some Midrashim do not mean literally. They don't mean that this is literally what happened. So that's step two. Sometimes two Midrashim can be conflicting. They're not conflicting. This Medrash is telling you, Pshat, what happened. This Medrash is not telling you what happened. It's telling you another message. It's telling you on the level of Remez, Drush, or Sod. It's not conflicting. That's why Vav and Ezra will sometimes go out against Chazal and the Radak as well. Our sages say things and they say, that's not pshat, right? What did they just say? It's not pshat. They didn't say it's not true. They said it's not pshat. Pshat in the story is different. Fine? So answer number two is that sometimes Midrashim are working on different levels. One Midrash is telling you in pshat what happened. Another Midrash is telling you on the level of Remez, Drush, or Sod. Say there, that's answer number two. Answer number three. Midrashim work with systems. We have 32 laws of derivation, which are in their own set of brisa. There's a brisa called Mishnas Rabbi Elazar, and Rabbi Elazar, I have a copy at home, you're welcome to see it. Rabbi Elazar wrote 32 laws of derivation, which everyone had. He just compiled it, laws of derivation for Medrash. If you want, the Shloha Kodosh wrote an expansion on it. If you want, in the introduction to Medrash Rabbah, the commentary Marzu wrote an expansion on each of the 32. So you have 32 laws of derivation. Now, sometimes two rabbis will analyze a pasuk, and they will have different sources of derivation to come up with a different interpretation. And they conflict. So sometimes two conflicting opinions don't stem from a knowledge of what happened back then. Because if you knew what was happening back then, you should have one answer, right? But sometimes they did not. They didn't have a tradition. Sometimes a Medrash is not based on tradition. Sometimes Medrash is based on derivation. Most of Medrash is tradition. Some of Medrash is derivation. That derivation has 32 laws which it can adhere to. And those laws are sometimes conflicting. And that's where we sometimes have machlokas. Sometimes this Medrash is going to say this law of derivation is most apt to apply, and the other one will disagree. And they can argue with one another, and they can each respect one another. And just like we find in Talmud and in Halacha, we have that. So too, you can have that in Medrash as well. So those are three possible answers. Let's recap. What we say? Guys, what was answer number one? The Gemara in Megillah. Sometimes they're both true. And the question is, which one was the prime catalyst? Like the story of Pelech Begiva. Answer number two was maybe they're on different levels. Pshat, Remez, Drush, Sod. Answer number three was laws of derivation. Maybe it is a machlokas, and maybe it stems from different laws of derivation. I'm not saying we did an exhaustive overview. We just gave three answers. There are more.